I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The bad news was just mailed to 120,000 alumni of Boston College. Dear friends, the letter said, last week Boston College discovered a security breach on a computer located on campus, blah, blah, blah. We are writing with a precautionary advisory that your social security number was on the computer. And can't you just feel that sinking in your stomach? What do? Call the bank, call the credit bureaus, and hope and pray that someone is not at this very minute refurnishing their home or buying a new car using your hard-earned credit. It's called identity theft. Ask anyone who's been through it, and it makes old-fashioned burglary sound attractive. You won't have to go far to find people who've been targeted. Over 3 million Americans have had their identity snitched each year. This hour, we'll talk about identity theft, how it happens, and what can be done. We'd like you to call in. Has this happened to you? And what's the fix? Does the credit industry need to do a better job of safeguarding our secrets? Or do lawmakers need to start taking this more seriously? Maybe it's us. Maybe it's our own desire to shop online, bank by phone, and use all the latest time-saving gimmicks that's catching up with us. Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, you might have heard of some of the other recent identity heists. Data companies like LexisNexis and ChoicePoint recently admitted that they'd mistakenly sold data to identity thieves posing as real businesses. No one is saying how many people's information is now at risk. Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. One of those people is Travis Saladay. He's joining us now on the line from Rancho Vista, California. Travis, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
How did you find out that your identity might have been stolen?
I received the letters in late February and opened them, my wife's and mine. And when I opened them, I was floored. Felt like I wanted to get sick right then and there. A feeling of anguish and disbelief that what I have tried to protect for 25 years, my identity, was gone and cannot be returned.
Had you done a pretty good job of you know, doing what you could to try and safeguard your identity?
Everything. I've been practicing safety since the early 1980s when credit card carbon paper was being stolen out of trash cans, and I was well aware of that. That's when I really started becoming aware of problems with identity and stealing of information.
You use a shredder at home?
I burned up four of them, yes.
You know, Travis, there are going to be some people listening to us and thinking, because they've never been exposed to this, identity theft, how bad could it be? What do they need to know?
What do they need to know? What it can do to you?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, some of the most important things in life, your credit is used. Companies use it for hiring. It's used for obtaining an apartment, a rental, home loans, car loans. Oh, it's endless.
But I mean, if somebody were to get their hands on your credit card and use it to buy a stereo or something like that, the way the system works is you'd be protected. You personally would be protected from having to cover that debt, wouldn't you?
Yes, but that's irrelevant. I mean, somebody's paying the price in the end. Somebody, either through higher prices, through higher interest rates. It's just not a good thing, period.
Do you know, Travis, if anybody has tried to take advantage of your identity yet?
I'm not really sure. I've seen a job on a report that wasn't mine.
Yeah.
So I really don't know. Not yet.
I mean, the reason I'm asking is, would you even know if somebody was taking advantage of your information?
You may not know. It may not show up on a credit report. Okay, you may have to order your consumer file.
Yeah.
Okay, it may be maybe they obtained a driver's license under your name, a identification under your name. And that is not going to show up on a credit report.
And I saw the letter from Boston College to the alumni saying, look, here's the list of things that you should do. And, I mean, it's a pretty exhaustive list. Even if you go through all that, calling the police and calling the credit reporting agencies, I mean, does it ever go away?
No. No. Once it's out there, once it's in the world, it can be sold and resold time and time again, this information, by criminals.
So you spend the rest of your life wondering if somebody's at some point going to take advantage of it.
I foresee many, many sleepless nights of worrying when and where my identity will be used. It will never end. The information will definitely be sold and resold time and time again. It's out there now.
Travis, I wish you the best of luck, and thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gordon.
That's Travis Saladay joining us there on the line from California. He is one of the people whose identity may have been compromised in a recent theft of identity from a company called ChoicePoint. Let's go next to Mari Frank. She is a consulting counsel for plaintiffs in the ChoicePoint case. She also sits on the advisory board of the California Office of Privacy Protection. She's joining us from a studio in Irvine, California. Mari, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Dick. I wanted to tell you that the number that you had given of $3 million is actually a low number. We found that the Federal Trade Commission did its own study, and there were almost 10 million new victims last year. And with all these security breaches, Dick, we're expecting even more.
I mean, 10 million a year, that's somebody on my street is going to have their identity stolen this year or next, right?
The FBI says 1 in 5 adults will become victims of identity theft this year.
You know what struck me, Mari? I was looking at the notes given to me by my colleague here, and they show that this happened to you, and not just last year, but almost 10 years ago.
Right. In 1996, I got a call from a company that I'd never heard of asking me why I had not paid my $11,000 bill to them. And I found out later that over $50,000 was stolen in my name. This woman was parading as an attorney, using my professional life as well as my personal life. She had rented a car and totaled it. I was being sued by Thrifty Rental Car. So it was havoc. And that's literally how I became an expert by necessity.
Okay, but you're a lawyer. I mean, if anybody's going to get themselves out from underneath this, it would be someone like you. Are you in the clear yet?
Oh, yes. It took me over 500 hours, 11 months, and the Identity Theft Resource Center did a study and found that the average time to get your life back is 600 hours.
Okay, that's depressing.
So, I've gotten it back, but, you know, I've been victimized by skimming in recent years as well, where someone skims the metal strip of the back of your credit card and transfers it to another card, and then they siphon the money off of it for that month, and you get that bill. That's not as difficult to deal with as when somebody does a whole identity takeover, where they literally use your credit, you have no idea. And then what Travis was talking about, the things that can happen is not just your credit being stolen, not just your professional license being stolen, or someone getting a job in your name and then you're responsible for the taxes, but we're talking about someone can even commit crimes in your name. And also the 9/11 terrorists used other identities to commit terrorism.
There's another wrinkle to this, Mari, though, and that is that in California, there are security breach laws that would at least let someone like Travis know that his identity had been compromised. My understanding is that there are people living in states elsewhere in the country who would never be informed if this had happened.
That's right. And what has happened is ChoicePoint had a problem in 2002 before our 2003 law, and they never disclosed. And there's many companies that don't disclose. The good news is because of the California law, when companies have to disclose to California citizens, the attorney generals in other states are up in arms and they say, wait a minute, you have to disclose to us too. So ChoicePoint has disclosed to other companies. And I think that's what happened in Boston, is that now that is becoming the standard, is that you must disclose.
All right, Mari, I'm going to ask you to just hang on for half a sec because I'm going to bring Evan Hendricks in on the program now. Evan is editor and publisher of Privacy Times, joining us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Evan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Dick.
Can I quote from a presentation that you made to the Senate Banking Committee last week? I was reading this, and I got really depressed. This is you talking to the senators, and you said, you know, we do not know what information these companies collect, where they collect it from, the manner in which they organize it or maintain it, the mechanisms that they have to ensure security, whether they audit their systems, and on down the list. These are the people who have all my vital information and yours?
That's right. And the first irony is that to adequately protect our privacy here, we need greater sunshine. We need transparency. ChoicePoint and LexisNexis and all these database companies are to some extent operating outside the law, and they are keeping, in effect, secret files on hundreds of millions of Americans, like the Stasi did.
Their explanation for that is that it has to be secret because they sell my information and your information. Is that right?
Yeah, it's just easier for them. They don't want to have to bother with people getting access to their records and correcting errors. And consumers are a nuisance. They want to traffic in our data. but they don't want to take responsibility for ensuring its security or interacting with us so we can ensure its accuracy.
Now, both Mari and you are in the business of trying to help consumers here and trying to bring some light to this. You're at the banking committee. Did they sit up? Are they paying attention? Is that where the answer lies?
Well, yes. In 25 years of working with Congress, I had never seen such spontaneous combustion of both Democratic and Republican senators jumping all over Choice Point because they couldn't answer how much money were they spending to protect the security of data. They couldn't describe what kind of procedures they had to ensure accuracy after a federal judge said that it wasn't clear what procedures they had, if any. I think that there's that this episode could be a tipping point in moving us toward broader and more comprehensive privacy protection.
Connection listeners, we are going to continue after the break with Evan Hendricks and Mari Frank as we talk about identity theft, how pervasive it is, what you can do about it. We're interested in hearing from you. Excuse me, have you been a victim of this and do you see a fix? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call us. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about identity theft. Are consumers to blame for wanting too much from the credit industry, too much that's instant and right away? How do you feel about the fact that all that information that belongs to you or that is about you is being sold? And what's the fix? Should it come from the credit industry? Should it come from the lawmakers? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With us on the program this hour, Mari Frank, an attorney who sits on the advisory board of the California Office of Privacy Protection. She's the author of a couple of books on ID theft, Safeguard Your Identity, and From Victim to Victor, The Guide to Ending the Nightmare of Identity Theft. Evan Hendricks is with us from Washington. He's editor and publisher of Privacy Times. Also an author, his book, Credit Scores and Credit Reports, How the System Really Works and What You Can Do. If you'd like to know more about those books and our guests, you can find that information through links on our website. Make a note of it, theconnection.org. We're going to take our first call from New Orleans, and Linda is on the line. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was a victim, a surprise victim of identity theft in about 2000 when I had a service contract in my home, and I went to put something on credit and thought I had perfect credit, and they called me and told me my credit was very bad. And I found out that someone had opened 5 credit cards in my name.
And not paid the bills, just run them up and walked away?
Yes, fake address, bought everything, had things shipped to them online, et cetera.
What did you do, Linda?
Besides crying, I called the credit card companies to see if I could work it that way, and they wanted a police report. I called the police to place a police report, but since I had no evidence, because all of the bills had been mailed to a false address or somebody else's address, I couldn't give them what they needed to file a police report. So it was like a vicious circle. So I had to go back to the credit card companies.
So when Mari says this is like 500, 600 hours of work to try and clean up this whole mess, is she pretty accurate when it comes to your case?
Yeah, absolutely, because it took me a good 5 months of calls and letter writing, and probably half of that time was spent with the credit services, just getting them to correct my information, and I found that they were very inaccurate. When I would call them, review my report, tell them what was incorrect, it would take several tries to get either incorrect names off of it, where they used my last name as a middle name, and to take those incorrect names off the reports.
Linda, do you think that there's a fix here that perhaps we're not thinking about, some idea that you had of how to prevent this happening to other people?
I think the most frustrating thing that I encountered at that time was that I put a fraud alert on my credit reports, but they were temporary. In other words, credit companies wouldn't allow you to put more than a temporary fraud alert on your account, and I think that that would be the most successful at keeping things from reoccurring. Now, how could you stop it? other than not letting people just go to credit card companies to get information about you without your permission, I think that would be the biggest thing.
You know, Linda, thanks for that call. Mari Frank, one of the things that amazes me about this is that Linda's talking about something that happened almost 5 years ago, and yet when I'm reading the stories of people like Travis Saliday and others who are being hit with this, they're having the same problems, filing police reports or getting the credit agencies to put some kind of alert on their file.
Dick, you're absolutely right. The same exact problems that I had in 1996 are still happening, even though we've got a lot of new laws. Let me just explain one thing that Linda said that's absolutely right. In 1997, when I testified in Congress, I said to them, look, we need to have some kind of a security freeze so that when you put a freeze on your credit report, no one can get it without a password. Well, we did pass a law in California that we do have a security freeze. What we found is the fraud alert, number one, she says it's only temporary. Right now, if you call for a fraud alert, they'll put it on for 90 days. And the only way you can get it on for up to 7 years is to have a identity theft report by a law enforcement agency, which is not easy to get. Not only that, in California and in Texas, Louisiana and Vermont, and I think some other states are starting to do this, we're passing laws saying that you can put a security freeze on your credit report that says no one can get your credit report unless you give a password.
Right.
So in other words, if I'm a victim in California for free, I can put a security freeze on with the password. And if I want to go buy a car at a Toyota dealership, I can have a thaw, so to speak, of that freeze and allow that particular company to get my credit report. We have found that many companies, even when there's a fraud alert, that they issue credit to the fraudster and change the address, just like what happened to Linda. Linda would not know what happened because all of the fraud accounts are going to another fraud address.
I want to try and keep this simple if I can. And Evan, let me turn to you on this one. We all are pretty dependent on credit cards today. And that means if we want to maintain our cards or our debit cards, we're then dependent on these credit reporting agencies. The big three, I think, are Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. Is that right?
That is correct.
Why is it that those three agencies, though, aren't more responsive to consumers who are losing their identity? Why is it that people like Linda and Mari and others have so much difficulty once their information's been compromised?
One word, money. They make more money selling credit reports, and they don't want to change their system. And what Linda's comments point up is that the credit report is at the epicenter of identity theft because the key moment comes when the fraudster applies for credit in your name. The credit bureaus are willing to disclose your credit history in the credit report to the credit granter, even though there might be big discrepancies in the address and other identifying information. That's what allows the fraudster to get credit in your name.
And the agencies are willing to do that because that's the point at which they make money?
Yes. I mean, first of all, they're selling the credit reports to the credit granters, and they do it on volume. And the financial services industry doesn't want to slow down that process. I've quoted authoritative reports that say that as bad as identity theft is, it's still fractional, and they're still willing to write all this off as a cost of doing business. So you just hope you're not hit by the bullet in this game of Russian roulette.
Is that changing?
Congress spent all of 2003 revamping and strengthening the Fair Credit Reporting Act to try and get them to respect fraud alerts and also to commission a lot of studies to look at these sort of criticisms that I'm raising about the credit reporting agencies. But the Choice Point affair shows that the system is still entirely full of holes. It puts the burden all on individuals. And that's why, like Mari has done a fantastic service in publishing, what steps consumers can take to try and minimize the damage. But we haven't gone to the root of the problem, and that's the lax attitude the credit bureaus have in terms of selling our identity when thieves apply for credit in our name.
We're going to take another call from Louisville, Kentucky, and John is with us on the line. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I don't think the problem so much is the credit reporting agencies as it is the people that are doing this stuff. I think.
What do you mean, the people who are doing which stuff?
Well, there's a good example. There used to be a website called ShadowCrew.com, and it's since been shut down by the Secret Service. And it was up for 2 or 3 years, and it was a message board, and you could openly go there and buy people's what were called infos. And there was their name, address, social security number, mother's maiden name, et cetera, enough to where with a fake ID you could open, go to a bank in person and open the bank account.
Well, it's a good thing a site like that shut down, isn't it, John?
It is, but it isn't. It definitely is a good thing, but the fact is these people, I think they caught like 28 people, but you got to think about the numbers of people that are doing this type of thing, and they're not gone because this website's gone. They've just moved on, and these are real intelligent people.
Well, I guess this is another large part of the problem. Mari, if we go back to a time when your identity was stolen Travis was saying, people were pulling carbon slips of credit cards out of the garbages of gas stations to steal people's identity. If there's that much money to be made in it, is there any chance law enforcement is going to be able to sort of keep pace with their own ingenuity here?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's tough on law enforcement. I'm a sheriff reserve in Orange County, California, and I can tell you that they get hundreds of cases per month. Only about 10% of these cases are investigated, and of those 10%, only about 10% are prosecuted. So John is right that the bad guys are taking advantage, but the reality is, even if you got all my information, if the credit bureaus and the credit reporting agencies, the credit card companies, were safeguarding and authenticating and verifying my identity, then I still wouldn't become a victim. So the reality is the financial industry, not maliciously, but I would say negligently, is facilitating this crime. So where do you think, when John says that there was a website with all this information, you could buy a social security number, they're getting that from these aggregators of data. They're buying and selling it. For example, in the Choice Point scenario, we have these Nigerian fraud rings setting up 50 bogus businesses that then were able to get that information from a reputable company like Choice Point. So John is right. The bad guys are taking advantage of getting this information because it is being bought and sold insidiously without our knowing about it. When Evan talks about shining the light, we need to know who is collecting what about us.
Let's go to Worcester, Mass, because I think this is a point that Joan is calling in on specifically. Am I right, Joan?
Sort of. The point I would like to bring some attention to is the root cause of all of this. There's a lot of blaming going on right now. But what's not been talked about is that the use of Social Security numbers that is now being done violates the whole purpose behind Social Security. I'm old enough so that my Social Security number, my card across the bottom, says in big letters, for Social Security purposes only.
Not for applying for a Filene's credit card, right?
Not for anything else.
Yeah.
And because it was so convenient, not only for users like me.
Yeah.
But for the people who wanted to have a universal identifier, it's being used that way, and Congress did not put any safeguards in to protect those numbers because it was for Social Security purposes only.
Let me, if I can, Joan, turn to Evan Hendricks on that one. I'm just wondering if that's, cow's already out of the barn. Is there any way to go back and kind of, well, what would the word be, Evan?
Well, there's lots of ways to improve protection for consumers, but it requires putting the rights of individuals ahead of the prerogatives of large organizations. The caller's point about Social Security number is extremely important. I always thought that this thing that Social Security number would only be used for Social Security was one of the great lies to the American people, on par with your check is in the mail. But in the credit reporting realm and in identity theft, the Social Security number is key. That's what the thieves want, because the algorithms of the credit reporting agencies will put a lot of more weight and importance on an exact match of a Social Security number, and that's what allows them to disregard discrepancies of your name and address when they disclose your credit report to the identity thieves' credit application.
But, should we be looking to a time when the Social Security number is no longer used as a key to our own credit history, but a new number is devised and much better protected, or some other way of doing it?
Well, there is, and there's been debate in Congress. And again, this is going to help boost that, is to roll back the areas of Social Security numbers used. And you have to give your Social Security number to your bank if you have an interest-bearing account, to your employer, and to government agencies. But you don't have to give it to your health insurer. They just like to have it. The same with your health club. There's legislation pending that would help roll that back. And what you really want is it's a bad practice to have someone else's number be the identification number for your system, because the farther it gets away from its original source, the more it gets corrupted. And that's why it's, you know, not only bad for identity thieves, it's a bad organizational practice.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us this hour as we talk about identity theft. Let's go next to Princeton, Massachusetts. Natasha's on the line. Hi, Natasha.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. Your line's not that great. Can I ask you to be brief?
Yes, I'm going through this right now. I had a housekeeper who stole my identity, and I'm amazed at how little law enforcement I have behind me, though the local police have been wonderful. They have not even arrested this woman. The courts have chosen not to do that. They're just summoning her to court. She has stolen my passport, stolen my license, my birth certificate. She was stealing checks from the back of my checkbook and using them. And on top of that, I have an in-home business, so she has gotten all of my business information.
And is she masquerading as you, Natasha? Is that the point here?
She's gone out and signed checks in my name, used credit cards. She was stealing credit cards from my wallet, then putting them back. We don't know how far this has gone yet. I can't plug the holes fast enough.
Why hasn't she been arrested? I don't quite understand that.
Either. It was a court's decision. All they've decided to do is summons this woman to court.
Mari, what's your understanding of this? Does this sound familiar to you?
Unfortunately, white-collar crime is the stepchild of our criminal justice system. The only time we're really getting law enforcement to be able to have the resources to deal with this is when it affects homeland security. But individual people like Natasha feel just totally lost in the system, frustrated. What I would say to Natasha that the most important thing for her is to get her life back and to put up barriers. Obviously, she has a right now, and I should tell you this, Natasha, that under federal law now, you have a right to write to each of the credit grantors and the banks that have issued accounts to her and demand that within 30 days they provide you all documentation of the fraud and to provide that to your law enforcement detective or the agency. That will help you to prosecute her because you'll get that information without a subpoena. So that is the law, but you must write a letter and you must include your identity theft report. When you get the evidence, it'll make it easier for the DA to take the case. Lots of times you'll get law enforcement to help you, but if they don't have enough evidence, the DA just won't take it. So that's my suggestion.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Just a reminder to our listeners, it's a complicated topic and it's hard to take notes on all the different ideas and suggestions and opportunities. Our two guests, Evan Hendricks and Mari Frank, have spent a lot of time figuring out how identity theft works and what the options are for different ways for people to protect themselves from having their identity stolen and what to do in case that happens. You can find information on our website, links to the books that they've written and the work that they do. We are at theconnection.org. I'm listening along, Evan, and wondering to myself, is any progress being made here?
Well, there's certainly growing public awareness, and the main thing that people need to do is monitor their credit reports. Your first caller, most people get ambushed by the problem. They get a call from a collector or they apply for credit and they're rejected because there's all this pollution on their credit report. And now we have the new law gives everyone a right to free credit reports. It's being phased in, so the East Coast is not entitled till September. But you can get it under state laws like Massachusetts, free reports. But you want to look at the three sections of your credit report. The last section is the inquiries. That shows what companies have pulled your credit report and why. And so if you live in Massachusetts and a car dealer in Texas pulls your credit report, that's a warning flag and you want to follow up on that. You also want to look for strange accounts that you don't recognize and suspicious change of addresses. Those are all signs of identity theft. And the sooner you can catch identity theft, the more you can minimize the problems coming from it.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 this hour. Program about identity theft. Has yours been taken? Who do you think's responsible? Is it the credit agencies or should lawmakers do more? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Evan Hendricks is with us this hour. He's editor and publisher of Privacy Times, author of Credit Scores and Credit Reports, How the System Really Works, What You Can Do. And Mari Frank is the author of two books on identity theft, Safeguard Your Identity and From Victim to Victor. And this hour we're talking about identity theft, just how pervasive it is and who's really responsible for helping us all through that. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Sarah's with us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I have a question. Your speaker made a comment that we don't need to give our Social Security number to Filene's and to the phone company or to any of those people.
Yeah.
But when you call, when you say you won't give it, they say, well, that's fine, but then we can't do business with you. And so I'm wondering if there are any other options. Health insurance all over, they say.
No, it's a great question, Sarah. Hang on. Let's try that one on Evan. I mean, what if we say no and they say, you know,
That's why we think there needs to be a law so they can't refuse you business. My point was that it's only by law that you have to give it to the banks, the employers, and the government agencies. You don't have to give it to those other organizations by law, but it's true. A lot of it just insist on it, and they say, well, that's just the way we organize our record-keeping systems. And it's frankly, it's quite stupid to do things that way. And so I hear from people that go to battle with these large organizations, you know, try and stand on principle, but it's a ridiculous hassle. And this is one place we need public policy and law to protect individuals so they don't have to fork over their Social Security number to join a health club.
And does that, would that law be any more effective if it was a federal law rather than something being done on a state-by-state basis, Evan?
Well, I think so. It'd be nice to have a federal law that would do that. But, you know, states have been much quicker in reacting to these problems of identity theft and privacy, which is why we also are very much against preempting state law, because most of the best ideas come out of states like California. So we want to keep them as the laboratory of democracy. One thing about all these laws, including our Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, which is a pretty good law, gives you rights. They're not self-enforcing, and there's a lot of noncompliance with it. So I've seen cases where people have only been able to get their credit reports cleaned up by filing a federal lawsuit. I think that's ridiculous, too, but that's the reality of our time.
Sarah, what do you think of all that?
I'm waiting for the laws to be passed.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering, Sarah, if you think about it, are we all too willing to give out too much information when it comes to, you know, our desire to get that, you know, in-store credit card with the discount that comes with it and all that kind of stuff?
I try really hard, and with the in-store, I often walk away. But the phone company and the health insurance, those are different matters. So maybe, yeah, I think I need those.
And that's right. And in Arizona, all the health insurance companies in Arizona have decided to stop using the Social Security number as the customer identifier. So that's an example of a rollback that we favor.
And California has passed laws that the Social Security number cannot be used for the health carrier. And that is going because big companies like Blue Shield, Blue Cross, Kaiser have found that they have to change for California. They are changing nationwide. So that's another reason what Evan was talking about, that when you've got a state that's more active in protecting privacy, it really affects the entire nation.
And Mari, I know that in looking through the nightmare facing all those Boston College alumni, the reporting in the local papers here said that other universities in the Boston area long ago switched over to an ID number that's distinct to the university without using the Social Security number. Is it that simple?
Well, that would help. I know they've changed it in California. My daughter, who goes to a University of California here, 2 years ago, her number was her Social Security number. And, of course, I was up in arms, and we did get the law passed, so it no longer is. It helps. But also, if they are going to have information on their computers that has sensitive information, it should be in encrypted files. Mm-hmm. We also had a big breach here in California with Chico State, up in Northern California, where this information was on a computer and stolen and not encrypted. So if companies would, at least companies and universities that do have sensitive information, if they would encrypt it, that would greatly reduce the chances of someone stealing the identities.
And Evan, just a couple of moments ago, we had a caller on the line who's no longer there, but he had a great question, and that is, wouldn't it just make sense, as awful as it seems, to switch over to a system of biometrics where really nobody can masquerade as me or you because they don't have the same fingerprint or retinal scan or whatever that kind of information is. Does that make sense or not?
It sounds great, but I don't think it will work because all of these are going to be dependent on software. And software is inherently exploitable. So if you can spoof the software that captures the biometric, you can end up doing the same kind of identity theft and convert a retina scan into a tool of identity theft. So I'm very leery of moving toward biometrics, and luckily the public is as well.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I would agree with Evan, and it's very scary right now because you have a lot of false positives and false negatives. So, you know, you think, okay, that's a unique part of your body if they use your fingerprint. But what Evan is talking about, and I've heard this from the Secret Service and the FBI, is that that can be corrupted like what Evan says. And then how can you prove this isn't you? I think it would be much more dangerous.
Let's take a call from Chatham County, North Carolina. Miriam is with us on the line. Hi, Miriam.
Hi there. Yeah, I really like your show. I listen to it almost every day.
Thank you.
My daughter's situation relates almost, well, directly to what you were just saying about university ID numbers.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to college in Virginia. She's only 18 years old, and she received an email that was sent to all of the university community saying that the server containing the information relating to their ID cards was illegally accessed.
Oh, what university was that?
Their names, their photos, their social security numbers, and their student ID numbers, which are not their social security numbers.
Do you mind telling us what the university was, Miriam?
It's George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
And what did the university advise your daughter to do?
The advice was very detailed. They gave specific advice about contacting the credit reporting agencies to put the fraud alert on the accounts. And they gave information about the government ID theft website.
Yeah, Miriam, she's 18 years old. How much of a credit? How much of a credit rating does she have at that age? I mean,
well, she does have her first credit card in her own name. But my situation, my thing that I'm really worried about, and I wasn't worried about it until I was listening to your program, is the 90-day fraud alert. I mean, if the crooks know that the fraud alert only goes on for 90 days, they wait until after the 90 days, and then they start doing stuff.
Mari, Evan, can you help Miriam with this?
Mari,
you
go
very
first.
Hang on, Miriam. Let's hear from Mari on this. Go ahead, Mari.
Miriam, you're bringing up several good points. And yes, not only does the 90-day fraud alert end without you writing the letter like what we talked about before, you must have your police report, but even while the 90-day fraud alert is on there, there are companies that are still issuing fraud. Not only that, and I don't mean to scare you, but I mean to raise your consciousness. Miriam, it could be problems for your daughter, even if she doesn't have credit, that someone else can use that good credit that she hasn't established yet. We have had situations where young people, 8 years old, 10 years old, their identity was stolen because their social security number was used to establish credit. That's showing you that these credit card companies are not even really delving into who these people are. But as far as your daughter is concerned, yes, she needs to put on the 7-year fraud alert. She needs to put up barriers, change her mother's maiden name on all of her accounts, and to get her credit reports and monitor them to make sure that no one is stealing her identity. It's probably a good idea also to do a background check on herself at least once a year, because these fraudsters will use these young people's identity to commit crimes. And methamphetamine is a good motivation to use another's identity to get money.
Dick, could I also comment on this?
Yeah, jump in.
Because you keep saying, well, what are the solutions here? And the overall solution is for we as individual consumers to be as plugged in to our personal information as all these thousands of companies are, so we are monitoring our information, and we're notified when there's significant changes to it. And what's interesting now is the ChoicePoint affair helped show this up, because when they sent 145,000 people these letters, they also offered the credit monitoring services for free. Now, these monitoring services are an example of what I'm talking about. They can send you alerts to changes in your credit report. So if that car dealer in Texas pulls your report, you know about it that mm-hmm. same day. But they're charging over $100 a year as a subscription. And so if you do all three, you're spending over $300. And it's like a protection racket because you're paying them to make sure they don't disclose your information to identity thief. And so I think that we should build on these models, but put a cap on it so they're reasonably priced, just the way Congress put a cap on the price of the credit report in past legislation.
Miriam, it sounds like you and your daughter have a new part-time job.
Yes. Now I'm wondering if maybe I should approach the university and make sure that the university does something to assure that all of these students get that 7-year fraud alert.
They can't assure it. You're going to have to write the letter yourself that right now the 7-year fraud alert is only available under federal law if you write the letter, send the police report, and an affidavit.
But Miriam's point, I think, is that she could advise the university to send that information out in an email to all the other students as well, no?
Well, my experience, and Evan can attest to this, is that the credit reporting agencies right now are following the letter of this new law. And I've had people call me from across the nation that if they don't have a proper identity theft report from law enforcement, that the credit reporting agencies will not put an extended fraud alert on, and they will not block the fraud. So that, you know, I hate to be raining on your possible sunshine here, but it hasn't worked so far. I don't think there's any problem with you going to the university and asking for them to make that demand. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Okay, Miriam. Quickly, Evan.
One other tip is that if you're disputing a fraudulent account on your credit report, the credit bureaus want you to put the fraudulent account name and number on the police affidavit that you turn into them. And that's the kind of inside baseball nobody knows about. But if you do that, it helps get the thing off. If you don't, you get the runaround.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about identity theft to Fort Knox, Kentucky next. And Jennifer's on the line. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
What do you think?
I just wanted to make a comment, and I am a college student, and I have transferred several universities, and some use your social security number and some assign you a personal ID, but my main concern is that my husband is in the service. He is active Army, and we've been married for 13 years, and from day one, everything is based on his social security number, from making a doctor's appointment to all the way down to signing your kids up for a sport to play on the installation. And we're passing that out daily, you know, depending on how many phone calls you make a day to agencies on post. That's their primary way of keeping track of service members and their families. And I'm just thinking...
So you sort of get used to handing that number out, Jennifer.
Yes, but it's every time it's extremely uncomfortable for me to just spit it out every time they ask me for it. And I'm thinking of all the service members, active Army, Air Force, even in the reserves. I mean, they're getting those Social Security numbers passed out all over the place. And it seems like they would have thought of this a long time ago to come up with some other personal ID number so that your Social Security number isn't always at access.
Evan, you would think so, no?
Yeah, Dick, this is why I try not to talk too much, because that is a very important call. And that is why identity theft is rising and spreading throughout our armed services. That's why people are overseas and they don't even know their identity is stolen, only to come home to this nightmare. And it is completely outrageous. The military has to change this practice immediately. Pressure's building, but they still have not changed the practice yet. And so your caller is very, very bright in knowing she has to look out for that. And still, it gets back to the fact that it puts the burden on her to constantly be monitoring her credit reports. Her right to a free report in the South will come on June 1st.
I made a point earlier,
Jennifer,
in the program,
also,
Mari, if I can just...
I just wanted to add something, that now under new federal law, you can put a military alert on your credit report. So even if you have not experienced fraud, I would suggest that you put a military alert on your credit reports.
What's a military alert?
It's similar to a fraud alert. And it says that someone is in the military and that they should take extra precautions before issuing credit. That's under the new federal law that was passed last year.
I mentioned a little earlier in the program, Mari, that you're consulting counsel in the plaintiffs for the Choice Point case, which I take to assume that there are people like Travis who are taking ChoicePoint to court for allowing their information to be sold. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a class action suit that people who have received these letters are all in the class, yes.
And I'm wondering is this the way to go? I mean, whether it's Boston College or Bank of America or ChoicePoint, if these large companies don't do a good enough job of safeguarding the information and they are being dragged into the courts, is that what's going to turn this?
I don't think that's entirely what's going to turn this. I think it's helpful because these people will hopefully get redress and will be able to address the needs of these victims. By the way, they're victims as soon as their information is stolen. Like you said originally, Dick, you get that letter and you get the sinking feeling. You already feel victimized, invaded. It's a horrible feeling because you don't know what's going to happen next to you. But the lawsuit is helpful, but I think what's really going to be helpful, Dick, is things like you're doing, is bringing it to the people so they're conscious of it, so that they write to the legislators. We need to put the pressure on Congress to make these changes. We're trying to do it now. There's legislation introduced by several different senators right now. Senator Feinstein's trying to kind of rein in the Social Security number like everybody's been talking about. Senator Nelson from Florida is trying to set up a system so these information brokers won't keep buying and selling our information, especially without telling us what's in there. And we don't even have a right to correct what's in there, by the way. There's a lot of errors in those systems. I think legislation is going to be the key, but it's going to be the media pushing the people to understand what's happening so they put pressure on their legislators.
Evan.
You need all of the above. You need litigation, you need legislation, and you need the wonderful service you're providing today. The important thing about litigation is that you get the companies under oath, so they actually have to describe what they do. And that's how we've learned how the credit bureaus operate. Because, like I said, I was up in front of the Senate a few weeks ago, and ChoicePoint had no meaningful answers. But if you get them in litigation, then they have to produce documents and answer questions under oath.
And in the long term, then, Evan, are we looking at forcing the lawmakers to tighten the rules on the credit industry or forcing the lawmakers to write their own laws that give consumers protection? Which is it, going both ways or one or the other?
Well, it's going to protect privacy, it's fair information practices, and there's two parts to it. The answer is yes to both. Give rights to individuals and you put duties and obligations on organizations that have the benefit of trafficking in our data.
Well, fascinating stuff, a little bit frightening, but I thank you both for your time on this. Evan Hendricks, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Evan is editor and publisher of Privacy Times. And Mari Frank, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mari is an attorney who sits on the advisory board of the California Office of Privacy Protection. Now, they are both authors. They have both written specifically about this. If you want to find out more, go to our website. We're at theconnection.org, and you could find links to the work that they and other agencies are doing right now. We also talked earlier on the program with Travis Saladay, who is one of the plaintiffs in the ChoicePoint case. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.